We're continuing now on Ramchal's discussion of what Chassidus is as he refers to the extra caution that a person must take not to impinge on another person in any way, either physically or offend him emotionally or in any way harm him economically. In the introduction to Mesillas Yesharim, Ramchal pointed out that the importance of learning this sefer is not in revealing anything new, although he does reveal much that is new, but claims that because there are things that we all accept and take for granted, that perhaps because they are so simple and taken for granted, we don't pay attention to them, and that we need this as a reminder. Therefore, he says this is a type of sefer that has to be reviewed very frequently, because we need frequent reminders about the kinds of things that we are likely to neglect as a matter of habit. In this particular Perek, where he talks about this particular chapter, where he talks about Chassidus and he defines Chassidus as he is doing it, we become aware of the overriding importance of Midas, of establishing appropriate character traits. And how far Midas can go is perhaps best demonstrated by an incident that I saw by Rabbi Yisrael Salant. And when I read it, it sort of makes a person tremble. In that community, there was a sort of a village square where the well-to-do people held their children's weddings, and after that had lavish affairs, as has become the custom so often. People who were not so well-to-do could not afford that kind of splurge, and they had much more modest things. Well, there was one shoemaker who had been one of the lesser luminaries of the community. And somehow or other, he had made some investments and became well-to-do, became rich. And yet the other wealthy people who were the elite looked down upon him as, you know, the nouveau riche, and he didn't belong. When his daughter got married, he was now well-to-do, and so he followed the fashion and had a big chasana. Yeah. And on the way to the wedding, you know, when the whole wedding party was going from their home to the wedding hall, one of the social elite comes over and goes over to this girl's father, who is that newcomer to the wealthy class, and takes a pair of shoes over to him, and he says, "Do you think that you still have time to fix these?" The story came to Rabbi Saul Salant, and Rabbi Saul Salant wept. And he says, "Now they are taking the Gedolei Hador, the leaders of generation, the Jewish leaders of the past generation, who are basking in their glory in Gan Eden, in paradise, and they are taking them to judgment for having neglected in teaching people proper midos." It is their liability. They are culpable that something like this could happen. It's just a shattering kind of remark. And Rabbi Yisrael Salant, if he said it, he's reliable that he knew what he was talking about. That a person who has a position of responsibility to teach and to lead has to teach people character traits, and that if he was negligent in doing so, And as a result of his dereliction, people did not develop. Now, if he did everything within his power, then he would not be held culpable. But if he was somehow negligent in not teaching properly, then years later, when he's already in Gan Eden and receiving his reward, and if another person's dignity is going to be offended, because he did not teach properly and he did not emphasize enough the importance of character traits, then he is going to be pulled out of Gan Eden and be brought before the heavenly tribunal and judged for this person's behavior. And it's just an absolutely bone-shattering kind of concept. But that's how far character traits are going. I really doubt that this would have been, that Rabbi Yisroel Salant would have said this if he had he heard, and we have no idea that he remarked this at any other time. What's the matter? There weren't people in that community who were not careful enough in Shabbos. And nevertheless, he never said, well, if anybody violates the Shabbos, right, then the tzaddikim of the previous generation are going to be called out of Gan Eden and held liable. Didn't say about anything else. As important as it is. And if a person did not was not careful and did not eat kashrus, we don't have any record that Rishon Salant said that the tzaddikim of the previous generation are going to be called out of Gan Eden. But only because somebody offended somebody else and embarrassed somebody else. He said, this is going to be held against them. And even though they are now in Gan Eden, they're going to be called back to trial. I don't know how your lawyers would look at that as what do you call that, double jeopardy? And once you've been awarded Gan Eden, you can't be called out. But the divine system of justice is apparently different.
There's no statute of limitations.
No statute of limitations. I mean, it's just a...
That kind of makes sense, though, because when you take away a person's personal dignity...
You've taken everything away from him. This is what we refer to as a Malbim B'Chaveh HaBarab.
Has there been any other time when someone's expressed that sort of a, someone being called out of Gan Eden for something, be accountable for something?
I've never heard of it before. The first time I came across it, this was so striking to me, right? And that's why, when we learn Midas, this is why it is such overriding importance, right, that a person develop his character traits. So he continues now. Ramchal continues saying, insofar as Chassidus in relating to another person, being cautious not to harm him by momoin in terms of his belongings. It means Lesaya Kasho Tasigyodo, that we should help another person as far as within our capability, Vilimnoya Mimenu Anizokim B'chal Mashiyuchot, to help him avoid any financial loss in whatever way we can. Certainly that a person himself should be cautious not to do anything that might harm someone else. But it's not only a question that I shouldn't do it, but if I know that somehow some harm can come to somebody, and I can do something to avert it, I have that obligation to do so. Tell about the Chibin Arov. Chibin Arov, I still knew him. I was fortunate to get to meet him yet. The Chibin Arov in his young years did not want to, like many others, did not want to benefit from his study of Torah, and did not want to take a position as a Rov where he felt that he would be exploiting his knowledge of Torah in order to make a living. And many Rabbonim were forced into their positions, because they felt that they didn't want to do this because this would be exploiting the Torah for. And those who did take positions very often took a very minimum salary, and the panosa used to be that the wife kept the store, or that the wife had the Rebbetzin had was given the exclusive on selling yeast. This was in many communities in the old country. That's how the Rav supported himself. And this was because very many of them did not want to take anything from the community coffers because they felt that this was exploiting their knowledge of Torah. At any rate, he became a jobber in selling coal, in buying coal from the coal mines and selling it to dealers. And one time, somebody came up with him, came up to him and wanted to arrange for a purchase of coal. And it was a fairly sized deal, and he could have made a good commission on it. But he had already just heard that there's going to be a drop in the price within a very short time. Right? So he told the person, if you don't have to buy the coal right this minute, I suggest that you wait a little while, because the price is going to drop and you'll save yourself a significant amount of money. By doing so, he also cut his commission. Right? But he felt that he had an obligation to tell the other person, since he had some inside information, that the price is going to go down, right, to save that person the expense when he could buy the coal 2 weeks later at a reduced price. This is just one example of how, if you know something that can help prevent another person's loss of money, that you have a chiyuv, have an obligation.
Couldn't he have taken the profits and given to like the orphans and widows or something?
That's right. And he could have taken the profits and given it to Tzedakah. However, in the Torah we have the Parsha of Truma, which talks about giving donations to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Mishkan, but that follows the Parsha of Mishpot. It follows the Parsha of those laws that govern commerce. Meaning, first you have to see that the money that you earn is absolutely clean. Then you can give tzedakah. The idea of, well, let me get what I can, and then I'll give tzedakah is unacceptable. Tzedakah has to be given from money that is earned with the greatest honesty.
And that was commission. Had he owned the coal, he might have been a whole different story. Rather than an inventory that would have done.
I don't know that. I don't know.
That would be really your own detriment rather than just giving up a future income. Here he would have actually sustained a loss himself.
Well, like anything else.
Maybe not. He would just not made a profit. Or a big profit.
If he was sitting on, let's say,
this discussion that we're having now indicates there's at least a question about it. Right, whether it's proper to do so had he owned it. Right? And in such a situation, a person who's in that predicament where he's not sure, well, am I mechuyev to tell the person, after all I own it, or am I not? Mm-hmm. What he should do is ask a shayla. Because if a milchik spoon is used to mix a fleshik pot, we go ask it of a shayla. Right? When it comes to economic matters, we become our own poiskim. There's a story of Meir Premishlana, one of the tzaddikim of several generations ago, where one day he received a letter. Meir Premishlana lived in poverty. One day he received a letter with a handsome donation addressed to Hatzadik, but Meir Premishlan, and from a very grateful person who said that he had come to Meir for a brocha because after many years of marriage they were childless, and Meir had given him a brocha that he would have a child, and his wife did indeed that year have a child, and so he's sending him this as a gratitude for a brocha. So the Meir looked at it. The family was thrilled that they're not going to have some money to buy the essentials. The Meir said, I can't keep this money. First of all, it's addressed to Hatzadik Meir, and that's not me. So it's addressed to the wrong person. Secondly, it's in payment for a brocha. My brochas are potent, and they can make people, people who are infertile have children. He said, the whole thing is a mistake. It's fraud. So I got to send the money back. The children became vehement. I mean, you send the money back. It's legitimately addressed to you. It was given to you. And, you know. And Rav Meir said, no, it's not justifiably mine. They finally convinced him to ask a shalom. So he convened the bezin and put the shalom before bezin. And, you know, bezin very well knew what was coming up. Bezin well knew what was coming up. And they said, you have every right to keep the money. So Rav Meir says, all right, he says, but I've got to take the question up with my wife too. So he went into his rebbesin and he told her. And she says, what is it with you? She says, whenever we have a shayla on something, whether it's kosher or not, right, and we ask and it turns out to be kosher, you say, once there's a shayla on it, I don't want to eat it, even though it's kosher. She says, and now just... You asked a shayla and it's kosher, so now you're going to take the money? I thought that your practice is you don't use anything that had a shayla. So he said, you're right, send the money back. Shows us who the male was, it shows us who the Robertson was.
Mr. Fishman.
Huh?
Mr. Fishman, who used to sell. This is old.
This is old and this is...
And this is newer. So this price stayed old.
Right.
Same item.
Same item, get it at the old price. Okay. One of the Gedalim, Rav Avraham Shaag, because he was such a trustworthy person, people used to give him things to keep for safekeeping for him. And he had an interesting practice. Whenever somebody gave him an item for safekeeping, he would take a mezuzah and put it inside the item and put it away. And he said, if ever a fire breaks out, right? So on Shabbos you're allowed to take out things that have kisvei kodesh, things that have sacred writings in them, you're allowed to save. Right? If chas v'shalom a fire broke out on Shabbos, right, he would now be permitted to take these things out so that the other person shouldn't have them. Now, this is looking at the wise person is one who can foresee the future. Taking precautions just in case anything were to happen, I've got to protect that person. Got to protect that person's property.
You can take the mezuzah out on Shabbos.
You don't have to. You'll have to take the item with the mezuzah.
No, but you're allowed to take the mezuzah out on Shabbos?
Sure. Mezuzah is not necessary.
Sure. No, but it'd be carried.
Yeah. Not into which you sign it, but into a chotzel, sheinim or revis, there's the question on the Hilchos Shabbos as to what you're allowed to take out into permissible areas. So he says, this applies bein liyochid bein l'rabin, whether it's an individual or something that would affect the community. Even though right now what you're going to do is not going to cause anyone any damage. Inasmuch as it can sometime in the future conceivably cause some harm, then you have to avoid doing it. Now, yisirim v'yavirim, you should avoid and get rid of something that may sometime in the future do harm. The Amar Chazal and the Chachamim said, here is the criteria. Right? Let another person's belongings be as dear to you as your own. Right? And the same kind of precautions that you would take on your own, right, that's how considerate you have to be of someone else. People who take shortcuts in being less than honest in their business affairs in order to earn money should consider the fact that not only is this a avera, not only is this a transgression of oinoa, of being deceptive, and there are many other things that involve, sometimes it involves frank lying or whatever, and possibly gzela or whatever, that it is also, in a way, a denial of hashgacha, denial of the supervision and providence of Hashem. Hashem is not going to give me what I need unless I commit some kind of dishonest act. So some of the Gedolim have said that a person has to realize that if he does something dishonestly in order to gain, right, that he is also really close to avodah zarah.
Okay, when the Rav revealed that if the man didn't necessarily have to buy the coal today, that he could save some money later on if he bought because he knew the price was going to drop, was it necessary for him to reveal that? Isn't that part of the art of the deal, as they say?
This sometimes is part of the...
Sometimes you have more information because maybe you've done more homework or, you know, and this guy's just not... He's just not a good businessman. He doesn't do his homework the way
this
he should
is,
do.
This is totally why we're talking about Hasidus.
Totally different.
Anybody that's involved in trading has got to capitalize on, take advantage of fluctuations in the market.
This is
you're talking about speculation.
No, okay. We're not talking about buying something. You always make your normal 10% whatever markup. But
no. Yeah, you make your markup.
But if,
okay.
but if you inventory things, I mean, you're obviously, I mean, at the risk. You're always subject to the perils of fluctuations in market value. By the same token, there's the other side of the coin too. And if you know that the market's going to go up or down, that's not the sign.
I don't know why this is so striking. It's happened to me a number of times, and I'm sure it's happened to you when I've gone into a department store, right? And the salesperson has said, this is going on sale next week. Right.
But it's not their pocket.
Right. And this is a question only because it is my pocket, right? And we just see this means if I can, if as a salesperson, right, I could save the other person some money because of information that I have, right? Then he felt that as midas chasidus, this is what he's required to do. Now, the fact that commercial acts follow that the dictum that do unto others before others do unto you, or all is fair in love and war, right? And business.
Let's start preemptive strike.
Two different benchmarks.
The sales lady was an employee, not an entrepreneur.
Come back next week when we're having a sale, we're marking down. You know, you wouldn't be happy with that sales lady.
I'm not so sure that I wouldn't be happy. I think that I would be thrilled that we're developing goodwill in customers.
I'm not sure about that.
It's a short term. It may be a short term loss and a long term gain of having.
I think they encourage the salespeople to do that.
Could be. Now,
up the street at the price.
We've got to be careful sometimes in the sense of how one approaches even halacha. There was an incident where Simchas Torah, when everybody was rejoicing with the Torah, the Rav saw that one person was really celebrating, dancing with the Torah. And this was the type of person who really had very little contact with Torah in one way or another. So he went up to him and he said, I'm thrilled to see that you're celebrating, you're so happy with Simchas Torah, but if Torah really means that much to you, you know, it would really be nice that we see you sometime coming to the Shia, to get more familiar with Torah, to be a little more observant of Torah. He says, then, you know, if you're really celebrating and it's so precious to you. So he says to him, let me tell you what happened. He says, I had a piece of property that I sold. And I made myself a good markup. Later on, the person who bought the property came back and he found out that I had taken a very stiff price and it was far over the market value, and wanted to take me to court to void the sale as having been fraudulent because I overcharged so much. But I remembered that one time when I did hear a Shia, they said that according to the halacha, on personal property, if you overcharge by more than a sixth, you can void the sale. But that in real property, according to halacha, the sale cannot be voided unless the overcharge is more than 100%. It's 100% or more. He says, I knew that if I would go into court, I might lose. But if I went to Din Torah, then I would win. So I convinced the person. I said, look, we're Jews after all. What are we going to go to a secular court for? Let's go to a Din Torah. So, and he listened to me, and he says, we went to a Din Torah, and he says, and I retained the profit from the sale. So He says, well, of course I'm happy with the Torah. So the Rav told him, he says, you know, Simchas Torah does not mean that you are happy with the Torah. Simchas Torah means that the Torah is happy with you. Right? Now he says, when you exploit the Torah for unjust purposes, he says, that's not Simchas Torah. Right? So you have to be careful that we don't exploit halacha for improper things. And this is why we have to learn such things as Chassidus. It's technically possible that one could win a trial as he did. He's right. The halacha is that it was a valid sale.
Is that the Achet Shechatanu with our das, or how's it called?
No, it's a Bivli das.
No.
Which one?
There's two of them. They say almost the same thing. One is knowingly and unknowingly. The other is with knowledge and without.
Right, yeah. The
Yadim
and the Averis that we did with our knowledge of that. So, look, we're talking about our Gedolim. We're talking about people like the Chofetz Chaim, who, because his practice, you know, his wife used to keep the store, and because he used to come in himself to check that the weights are, the balances are accurate, that the merchandise is fresh, that she gets rid of merchandise that is not good. And because he was so extremely honest and trustworthy, he used to have a lot of customers. Okay? And he became concerned that there's more customers coming to him than to others. Okay? And in a way, he saw this as exploiting the fact that he was behaving according to Chassidus, right? That now he's affecting others. So he made his wife close the store at noon. Let customers go elsewhere. Now, somebody will say, now look, we're talking about examples of Reb Shlomo Salant and the Chofetz Chaim and the Tzaddikim. What do you want from us? When you expect me to be a Reb Shlomo Salant, you expect me to be a Chofetz Chaim.
So, yes.
And I think that one of the ways we should look at, you know, a lot of us will buy a lottery ticket. The chances of becoming a Chofetz Chaim are greater than the chances of winning the lottery. Is it possible for me to become a tzaddik like the previous tzaddikim? The chances are that I could. What are the chances? 1 in 1,000,000? Hey, come on, I'm willing to invest money. The only thing is that to invest $1 is a little effort. To use that chance of 1 in 1,000,000 to become like one of the previous tzaddikim, right? It's not that the chances are any less. It's that it takes more effort. And then somebody said, well, you expect me to become a Chofetz Chaim? I said, what's the matter? You don't expect to win the lottery? The chances of your becoming a Chofetz Chaim are greater than winning the lottery, if only you're willing to make the investment. We'll continue. This is next time. We're continuing now on the elaboration of what does Chassidus consist of. And Ramchal had said that Chassidus, insofar as it relates to Bein Odom L'Chaveroi, in relationships between people, can be divided into three portions: to avoid harming someone physically, to avoid harming someone economically, and to avoid harming someone emotionally. And so he says, by nefesh, insofar as emotional harm is concerned, sheyishtadel la'asos l'chaveroi, that a person must try to do for another person kol kairas ruach sheyesh biyodoi, whatever is possible that he can do to make things pleasant for another person. Bein binyonei hakovod, whether it is in regard to giving him respect. And although a person should minimize the importance of kovod, of honor, that's for oneself. One does not pursue a claim and honor for oneself. But it's not worthless, should not be considered worthless to give to others. Others may need it, and therefore one should try to give others whatever respect is within one's possibility. Or in any other way. In any way that he knows, that if he does this thing for a person, the other person would be pleased with it. Then it is a mitzvah of chassidus. This is the a component of chassidus, to do something that we know would give another person a nachas ruach. The Gemara says that Hillel knew of a oni ben toivim, a poor person who came from a highly respectable family. And the family that he came from had been well-to-do and used to go in ceremonially with a crier going before them, which was apparently the custom of the nobility then. So that they had somebody running before the coach announcing so-and-so is coming. Well, this person had come from a family of nobility, but he unfortunately had lost everything and was impoverished. And Hillel hired for him a horse to ride on and a crier to run before him. He felt that if this person needed it, this was his necessities. One time, he couldn't find anybody to hire as a runner, as a crier before him. So Hillel himself, the Gemara says, ran before him as a crier for 3 milen, for 3 miles, whatever it was. And Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz says, look, he says, if this person, this Oni, had been bereft of his wits, there would have, I mean, you don't, a person who's insane and has absurd demands with his insanity says, there's no mitzvah to comply with his wishes. He says, so you have to say that this person was in every way a reasonable person. And we just had this one weakness that he needed this covet. So he was not an insane person. He says that just shows you how covet can distort a person's judgment. That even though this person was a reasonable person in every other way, that in this one area he felt that he needed this mishugas of having a crier run before. Then he goes on to say, but let's look at what Hillel did. All right, that he gave tzedakah that the person should have a crier before him. Good, like the Kotzka says, to give a fool his narishkeit, to give a fool his folly is also tzedakah. Yeah. But for Hillel to run before him, I mean, Hillel was a nasi. And there was the respect of the position, the dignity of the position. How did Hillel allow himself to jeopardize the dignity of the position of the Nasi and to run before this guy as a crier? He says, so you have to say that Hillel must have made the judgment because he felt that for this person not to have the crier would have been pikuach nefesh. He would have taken it so seriously to heart that it could have jeopardized his life. He says otherwise Hillel would not have lowered the dignity of the position he was in to give in to this person's whims. He says, so you see how far COVID can go. That a person can be in the position where if he doesn't get what he feels is the covet coming to him, then it can be life-threatening. And you can also see, as to what the Ramchal says over here, the degree of obligation to give another person a keres ruach. The Cholshken, if we say that a person is obligated to do as chassidus, a person is obligated to do whatever he knows the other person would take pleasure in. V'cholshken shelo yitzaranu, and certainly that he should not cause him any suffering. B'shum mine tzar klo, certainly never to cause another person any kind of distress. Yeh be'ezo v'shiyeh, in whichever way possible. There's a story about a chosid of the Blesheva Rebbe, the old Blesheva Rebbe, who was a devoted chosid and was childless and constantly asked the Blesheva for a brocha that he would have children. And the Blesheva gave him a brocha, but the brocha never came to fruition. One time, the Blesheva's brother, was the chosid of the Rebbe, was visiting. And so the chosid went to take shalom by the Rebbe's brother. And he told him that he was childless and asked for a brocha. So the Rebbe said to him, "Come to me and be with me on Rosh Hashanah, and I will guarantee you a child." So he went back and said it to brother, to the Blesheva. And he told him what his brother had said. So he said to him, "Look, if my brother told you that if you'll leave him by Rosh Hashanah, he'll guarantee you a child, then you don't have anything to be concerned about, you know. If he says these words, if he used an expression that he'll guarantee you, you can rely on him that he knows what he's talking about." Okay. Came Rosh Hashanah, the Blesheva notices this chosid is there by him. He goes over to him and he says, "What are you doing here? You're supposed to be my brother on Rosh Hashanah." So he said, "I had made up my mind to go, but then it occurred to me that all of these years that I've asked the Rebbe for a brocha, and the Rebbe gave me a brocha, and I did not have any children. And now I would go to the Hosadova, and then I would have a child." He says, "I know that it would please you very much, but it's not beyond possibility that it would hurt you also that your brochas were not, that your brother's brochas were fulfilled and that your brochas weren't, and that even though it's your brother and you're very close with him, still it might cause you some distress. So I thought, because I want to have children, that's what I should cause you distress." So the Blesheva said, "If that's the case, then I'll guarantee it." This story was told by a grandchild of the person who was born from that. And the Blesheva said, "It's not a moifus. This was not benign." He said, "If a person has that much mesilas nefesh, that he is willing to put his entire future generations in jeopardy, simply because he doesn't want to possibly cause a hurt to someone," he said, "then he has earned it." He said, "It was not a moifus. He earned it for himself." The Medrash says that one of the reasons that Moshe Rabbeinu was hesitant to accept the mission to deliver Klal Yisrael from Mitzrayim was because he was 3 years younger than Aaron. He had a brother. Aaron was a Navi before Moshe was. Right? And he felt that Aaron would be slighted by it. Now we see from there that here you have a situation where Klal Yisrael is at risk. Okay. I mean, when you start to talk about 600,000 people, you're talking about people from males from 20 to 60, right? Meaning that if you extrapolate, you're probably dealing with 2 million people or more, and you're dealing with the future of Klal Yisrael. Right? And Moshe Rabbeinu says, "But my brother might be hurt. My brother might be offended." And it wasn't until Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, "V'roach v'samach b'livoy, Aaron will greet you and he will rejoice in it." And then Moshe Rabbeinu was reassured that Ang is not going to be offended by it. He says, hey, you see what how important it is to avoid offending someone else. Moshe Rabbeinu had his calculation was, right now I don't have to worry about the future of Kali Sol. The future of Kali Sol is in Hashem's hands. Shlach Rabbi Atish, I'll send somebody else. Not my responsibility. My responsibility is how I get along with another person. Those are the kind of calculations that Tzaddikim have. What I have to do right now, that's my business. What the future is going to be in whatever Kali Yisrael, those are very serious considerations, but that's not my responsibility. And they clearly defined what was his responsibility and what was Hashem's responsibility. That's how far it goes. That's how far it goes, not to offend someone else. The Gemara says that the Chorban of the Reis HaMikdash, the destruction of the Reis HaMikdash, occurred as a result of the incidents of Kamsa, Baal Kamsa, where he sent to invite Kamsa, and he invited Baal Kamsa. And you see that the Rabbi Shalom allowed that to be the vehicle that brought the destruction of the Reis HaMikdash and the exile of Israel. What? That somebody was offended. The Chorban came as a result of somebody having been humiliated. Well, Chaim Levitz says, he says, look how far it is necessary to protect a person's honor. It says that by Bilam, that right after the incident with the donkey, that donkey died. And the Metla says, this is so that had the donkey been permitted to still live and walk in the streets, people would have said, huh, that's the donkey that made a fool out of Bilam. Right? So Reb Chaim says, take a look whose honor the Ben Yishlanim is protecting. Bilam is the worst of the worst. He was a Sinai Yisrael. He was the prototype of anti-Semitism. He was a moral degenerate. I mean, there's nobody worse in biblical history than Bilam. And yet, it was his honor that Hashem protected. So you see how you have to be careful to avoid harming someone's dignity, even when that person is a Rosh. And it's not what we call a Rosh. You know, we can call a Rosh somebody who doesn't deserve to be called a Rosh. But Bilam is a classic Rosh, the Chachamim call a Rosh. And yet Hashem protected his honor. Gemara says that
the Rosh is from Bilam. First, the Rosh is from Bilam was because of his greatness. He had the potential to be great. This is why he was.
Yeah, but whichever way.
For a typical Rosh.
Yeah, but whichever way you.
I mean, Paro was not Tzaddik either. And much more is told explicitly about Paro than is told about Bilam.
But you don't see Paro's degeneracy the way you see Bilam's degeneracy. I mean, Bilam was a pervert.
In the Torah itself, Bilam doesn't come off.
No, he comes.
Paro comes off a lot worse.
No, in the Torah you get Bilam as being a anti-Semite, but that's it. But the Medrash kind of
says
that Bilam was a moral degenerate. And yet, this person who was the lowest of the low, right? Hashem protects his honor. Right?
And yes, Hashem spoke to Bilam.
Oh, that
and Hashem did not speak to Paro.
Why that has been? Bilam was a novi, Paro wasn't.
No, that's what I mean. Yeah. He was a novi. He had a greater, he had tremendous potential. Yeah. And that's why he's.
I mean, he was a novi with the potential of Moshe.
That's why he's Moshe.
The Gemara brings down an the famous incident that happened when Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi and Rabbi Yeshua was the outstanding scholar, and on several occasions Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua got into a scholarly argument, and Rabbi Gamliel was not concerned about his personal honor, but he felt that Rabbi Yeshua was threatening the authority of the position of the Nasi, and that he could not allow. So he rebuked Rabbi Yeshua. And he rebuked Rabbi Yeshua publicly. The rest of the Talmidim could not tolerate this. They felt it was an offense to Rabbi Yeshua. And they deposed Rabbi Gamliel. And they deposed Rabbi Gamliel. The question is, who's going to be the Nasi? And they said, look, Rabbi Yeshua, it can't be. Because he was the adversary in the case. And you can't do such a thing as taking, even though Rabbi Yeshua was deserving of that position, you can't do such a thing, depose Rabbi Gamliel, and put Rabbi Yeshua in the position. I mean, if we have to depose Rabbi Gamliel, it has to be done, but we can't depose Rabbi Yeshua. This is when they turned to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who we have in the Agoda, who was 18 years old, and had the Nes. Okay. So we see that that Chachamim felt that they had to protect Rabbi Gamliel's honor, even though he was going to be deposed. So Chaim Shmulevitch says, we find a similar incident that by Kairach was had his 250, Rosh Hashanah had 250 leading of the scholars who were with him, and they died in the fire that broke out when they tried to bring incense and act as Kahanim. And then Hashem says to Moshe, tell Elazar, Aaron's son, to take the copper pans that they used for the incense and make a covering for the Mizbeach, that this should serve as an eternal reminder. This is the copper of the pans that people who were not Kahanim used to try to act the part of Kohen, which they were not authorized to do, and they suffered the punishment of being burned to death. So Aaron was supposed to do it. Right? So the Medrash says, Elazar was supposed to do it. So the Medrash says, why not Aaron? I mean, Aaron was not around. He was the Kohen Gadol. Why Elazar? He says, because Aaron was the adversary in the case. Right? Aaron was the one against whom they were arguing that Aaron did not deserve the position. And Kairach wanted it. Okay? So he said, to allow Aaron to take the pants would have been an offense against their dignity. Too much. Right? He says, again, look whose honor you're protecting. Right? But Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yeshua was a Kodosh. Right? Rabbi Gamliel was a Kodosh. Right? And even though Rabbi Gamliel had to be deposed because of having offended Rabbi Yeshua, right, we understand that in order to protect the honor of the Nasi of Rabbi Gamliel, that they did not want to choose Rabbi Yeshua. I understand that. But here, these 250 people died already. You want to do this as a kind of perpetuating the incident so people should remember. Right? So you tell Elazar to do it and not Aaron. Why? Because for Aaron to do it would be too much of a punishment for these 250 people who already had died. He says, what are you teaching us there? He says, the punishment that they got was what was meted out to them according to what they had done. The fact that a kind of eternal monument had to be set up to this for people to know that not to challenge the kahuna, that had to be done. He says, but to allow Aaron to do it, when he was the one against whom they had argued, to Aaron to do it, that was just a bit too much. He says, that's how exact the Torah is in, number one, how much punishment a person is to get for his offense, and secondly, how sensitive the Torah is to protect the dignity even of people who deserved that kind of punishment. And therefore, it was given to Elazar and not to Aaron. For Aaron, who was the one against whom they argued to do it, that would have been too much for them to have to bear. We see, the Torah tells us, the mice of Yehuda and Tamar. Right? That Tamar was pregnant by Yehuda, and Yehuda had assumed that she had committed adultery and ordered her to be burnt, to be executed by being burnt. And she did not reveal that it was Yehuda. She sent the items, and she says, I am pregnant to the man who owns these. Now, she took a risk there, because Yehuda could have easily have said, I haven't the slightest idea who this is. And she would have then been burned. Okay? The Medrash says that Tamar knew b'nevuah that she had Malchus Beis Dovid, that she was to be the mother of Malchus Beis Dovid. Right? That David was to come out from the child that she was pregnant with. And yet, and that if she would be put to death, right, then Malchus Beis Dovid was in jeopardy. Right? But she felt she cannot reveal and humiliate Yehuda. Right? And the Gemara says that a person should be ready to allow himself to be burnt to death, to be thrown into a fiery furnace, and not humiliate another person. And that was what we learned from Tamar. And it was not only that she personally would have been put to death, but she was, like Moshe Rabbeinu would call Yisro, she was willing to put Malchus Beis Dovid into jeopardy, okay, simply to protect the dignity of Yehuda. These are the kinds of things that we learn out from incidents in Torah as to how far a person is obligated to protect someone else. And as we said, when we talked about Malbin Pendecha Vera Brahman, somebody who humiliates someone else publicly, the Gemara says, Kola Yodim Le Gehenim Oilin. Gehenim is a cleansing process which is temporary. And everybody who goes to Gehenim stays there for whatever assigned period of time it is, and then is brought up out of Gehenim into Gan Eden. Kol ha'yodim le'gehenim oilim. All who go down to Gehenim are brought out. Chutz v'malm p'nechaber abrahman, with the one exception. Somebody who humiliated someone else publicly goes down to Gehenim and never comes up. So this is what he's saying. Not to offend anyone's nefesh. Not to offend anyone emotionally, and not to do anything against a person's dignity. Uchlal calls the comprehensive rule on this is Gemilas Chasodim. This belongs to the category of Gemilas Chasodim, Asher Hefligu Chachomim Zal B'Shiv Chol Chavaseinobo, where the Chachomim go to a great labors to praise Gemilas Chasodim and tell us what our obligations are in Gemilas Chasodim. But Bechlal Zayin, this also includes Redifas HaSholem, trying to bring peace between people. Shehu HaTova HaKlolis Ben Kol Adam Chavera, which is the ultimate good between people. As we say, Aaron was the Oyev Shalom, the Roidev Shalom. That Aaron HaKayan pursued peace, and he pursued peace by trying to bring people closer together, telling one person that the other person really wanted to make peace with him, but was too embarrassed, and whatever tactics he used to bring peace to people. I'm going to bring you a few examples from the Talmud where they spoke about Hasidus. Even though there's really no need for me to bring incidents, because the merit, the subject can stand on its own merits. Nevertheless, he says, just to reinforce it, let me bring a few incidents. The Terek Bnei Ha'ir and the Gemara of Megillah Omro, the Gemara says, Shavat Talmidav is Rav Zakkai, the student says, Rav Zakkai, Ben Maharach the Yomim. To what do you attribute the brocha that you had of longevity, living to a ripe old age? Omar Lahem, so he said, Miyomala Ishtanti Bazaihaba Meshal Tfila. I never relieved myself in a place where I thought that nearby here a person may one time wish to doubt. You have to realize that those days there were no modern facilities, and that people relieved themselves wherever. And Zaka said, but I had to consider, is it possible that I am in a place where a person sometime later may come and want to daven nearby here, and it would not be respectful, right? So he said, so he had to think ahead and be concerned of something which most people might not even take into consideration. V'lechinisi shem l'chaveri. I never called anyone by a nickname. Never called anyone by a nickname. As we'll see later on, another author of the Talmud said it also. And this does not mean a nasty nickname. It simply is that unless a person accepts this and wishes to be called that, that you're not allowed to call. So there was a ma'aseh by the Chiddush Yerim once that he heard someone refer to somebody else as the blinde Yankel. The blind Yankel was a blind person, a sightless person. And they referred to him as the blinde, as the blind person. So the Chiddush Yerim says, look, the person has a physical defect. Now, what right do you have to use that as some kind of a mentioning his physical defect? So this person says, but look, everybody calls him that. So Chiddush Yerim says, so what's the matter? There isn't room in hell for one more. All of the rest that do it will also be in Gehenna, he says. So you do it along with them, so you'll be in Gehenna along with them. As we'll see later on, even if it is not a derogatory nickname, he says, I never called anybody by anything except
a prophet. This used to be very common.
Oh, of course it used to be common. People have...
This is they identify people.
Right, and you have to be extremely cautious. That's like the Chiddush Yerim said. There's always room in hell for one more. And just because everybody does it does not mean that it's acceptable. To be continued. Having described what he considers to be Chassidus, Ramchal now wishes to bring some supports to it, to his concept, from incidents mentioned in the Talmud. And quotes the Talmud as saying, Shalu Talmid of Rav Zakkai, the students asked Rav Zakkai, Bema harachta yomim? By what merit, by virtue of what, did you deserve longevity? Amar lahem, so he said to them, Miyomai lahishtandi b'teich ab amesh latfila. I never relieved myself in a place where I might think that someone might in the future wish to daven nearby. And we were talking about those days when facilities were not available. And even then he would think ahead, is it possible that sometimes I might that I might be interfering with someone's wish to daven here. I never called anyone else by a nickname. And I never missed making Kiddush on Shabbos. I had an elderly mother. One time she sold her headpiece because I couldn't afford to buy wine for Shabbos, and she must have sensed how upset I was, and she went ahead and sold her headpiece to bring me wine for Kiddush. Now here this is an indication not only of his chassidus but also of his mother's chassidus. that the halacha is that if a person does not have wine for Kiddush, there's no requirement that he sell any of his belongings to buy wine. This indicates not only how considerate she was, but also that she sensed how upset he would be if he would not have wine for Kiddush. And even though the halacha does not require it, she went ahead and sold her headpiece for him. So you see here examples, the mashenageya el diktuka hamitzvahs, that Hasidus refers to a diligence in observing mitzvahs over and above what one is required to do. According to the requirement of the halacha, he was not required to sell anything to buy wine for Kiddush, since he did not have. To the point where his mother went ahead and sold her headpiece for it. And this is an example of the fact that both he and his mother observed mitzvahs above and beyond that which the halacha required. Now the Kiddush is an example as far as chassidus between him and Hashem. But it wasn't only a one-sided kind of chassidus that he was extra observant in ritual, because that already we can find, that people who are extra observant in ritual but they neglect their social obligations. And he says as far as what concerns the dignity of his friend, that he never called a person by a nickname, even though it was not an insulting nickname. And he felt that even that is improper. A person's name is the name that he should be called by, unless an individual adopts a nickname that he prefers himself to be called by. One should not use anything other than the person's given name. We find a similar case, the Rav Huna Gamken Kosher Gmi Alavusha. We found a case where the Talmud tells that Rav Huna had to tear off a band of long leaf from a reed bush, because he had sold his belt that he too had done something like this. Again, examples of where they went beyond what was necessary. Again it is said, Shalu Talmidov es Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. The students asked Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua, the Maharach v'yamim, by virtue of what did you merit long life? Amar lahem, and he said to them, Miyamai layasisi kapandaya lebeis haknesses. I never used a shul as a shortcut. Now, some people might think, look, what's the problem? Instead of going all the way around the block, if I just cut through, come in the front door over here and the back door there, I'll save myself a half a block. Well, the halacha is that you don't use a shul for a shortcut. And this halacha is based on the Midas Chassidus of Rav Elazar ben Shemua. But as much as he said that this is the improper thing to do, that his Midas Chassidus has now become our halacha. Now, it is an indication of the reverence with which they held a Beis HaKnesses, with which they held the shul.
Is that the only reason?
That's the only reason. So, now, this is, in our days, I think it has an importance, because we fail to show reverence, adequate reverence for a basic nesses, when people come into shul and carry on conversations, as we so often do, talking in shul. And talking in shul is considered to be a grievous sin, and yet, in spite of the fact that all of the mepharshim talk about the gravity of the event of talking in shul, and this is not only talking during davening, but simply carrying on conversation in shul. People carry on in shul as though it was a non-sacred place. We have the problem in many shuls of making it into a babysitting place where parents bring their young children during davening and allow them to run around. Now, the parents can have the child sit by them and decently, and the child can sit throughout the davening, fine. But if the child is going to run around and make noise and disturb others, that is hardly a dechavos for the shul. And perhaps if adults had had the proper reverence for the shul, as is pointed out here, and would refrain from talking in shul, and when they would come in, would immediately begin davening, and children, bring along their children, who would see that the shul is a place where one does nothing other than daven, then there's greater likelihood that the children might develop that kind of attitude of respect for shul. There used to be arguments in the old country about whether one is allowed to learn in shul. And in some places where the Beis Medrash, which was used for learning, became overfilled, and people wanted to then begin using the shul for learning, there was opposition to that. They considered learning in shul, some people considered learning in shul, undignified. Now,
are you talking about learning when there is no davening going on?
Or right, when there's no davening going on.
Because I know Rabbi Posner once made the comment, people learn during the davening. He said, the learning is not learning, and the davening is not davening.
Well, that's another point, that the Yetzer Hara very seldom comes to a person and tells him to pick up a sefer when he's watching a ball game. But as soon as you come to davening, then you're seized with a passion to look into a sefer. And that's clearly the work of the Yetzer Hara, because he doesn't come at other times. To me, it turned out to be comical when I heard that in one town the Beis Medrash had become overfilled and they were going to learn in the shul, and an argument broke out, and one of the members pounded his fist on the table and said, "Who ever heard of learning in a Mokum Kodesh?" Yes, I think to be everybody else did do it about the covers. But the attitude was at that time that the shul should be for davening.
When you say shul, you mean the shul room, not the shul building.
No, the shul room.
The shul room.
Right. The now the social hall and the foyer and the shul, that's not the condition we're talking about.
So if I wanted to go to the kollel by way of cutting through the Russian shul, the building, that's no problem. It's a question of going through the shul itself as far as being a...
I would guess. I would suggest that one would have to ask a shaila as to whether the parts of the building that are accessories to the shul itself, whether they have any din of kiddusha at all. My guess is that it would probably should be permissible, but I...
Would part of the reason for this be like a form of me'ilah, like you're not supposed to say, I shouldn't be sitting here working on something out of my briefcase in the shul, where I'm utilizing the shul's utility, doing whatever, not just a question of kedusha.
I think it's clearly a question of the hats.
Yet there's a story that we discussed where at one point they enforced this no talking ban, and the whole congregation did it, and then sometime later the rabbi said, we can't do this because people aren't visiting the sick. Nobody knows what's going on. In other words, indicating that...
Let them go to the mikveh.
Shul is... very good.
Yeah, that shul is a good social mixed place. I think that the solution to that is let them get together after davening and talk, and not during davening. Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua also said another reason that he felt that he had merited longevity is v'loy posati of Roshi Am Kodesh. When people were sitting and learning, and I had to pass by, I avoided passing by in a fashion that I would be disturbing them. So I went out of my way not to walk above where people were assembled. Hine zeh chasidus. This is a example of chasidus. Be'inyi kveid ve'sakneses, as far as showing respect for the shul. Uv'inyi kveid abriyes, and as far as showing respect for people. Shalei liksay al gam misiboson, not to walk by where people were seated learning. Shalei lo'oz kibavazo yison, not to give any example that, not to give any indication that he was belittling them by being indifferent to their studying and interrupting them. Oicham, furthermore, Shalu Talmidei Es Reb Preda, they asked Reb Preda b'Ma'arach D'Yomim, by what virtue did you have long life? Amar lahem, he answered them, Miyomar lo kidmani adam leBeis HaNefesh. No one ever preceded me to shul. I was always the first to open the Beis HaNefesh. Now, some people, actually he's talking about Beis HaNefesh, which is the house of study, not talking about Beis HaKnesses. But there is a mitzvah to be one of the first 10. And unfortunately, some people who come to shul straggle in at all hours. And there's no dacheretz in that. I've often said that I would like people to take the attitude, both toward learning and toward davening, that was enforced in medical school. Our pathology lecture began at 8 o'clock. At 8 o'clock, the doors were closed. If somebody showed up at 8:01, whether because he had a flat tire or for any other legitimate reason, there was simply no entry. And you can, and it was a crucial thing not to miss a pathology lecture, because that was the course that either passed or flunked in the second year of medical school. And you better believe that people were there at a quarter to eight, and they made enough time that if you'd have a flat tire that you could still get there. There was this horrendous fear that you'd miss a pathology lecture. Now, that's the kind of attitude that people should have if the davening is at 8 o'clock, to be there at 10 to 8. Unfortunately, we can't say that it's anything but a lack of proper concern that people straggle into davening at any hour. And the same thing in this method is, if a shiur is supposed to be at a given time, then everybody should be there at the time and give it the same respect as they would, as they do for other things that are not kiddushin. V'lo derachti lifnei kohen. I never usurped the right of a kohen to have the honor of benching, or the first aliyah, or whatever. There is a practice in some place that they will call up a Yisrael to the first aliyah, even in the presence of a kohen, and say b'mechilas hakohen, with the forgiveness of the kohen, with the permission of the kohen. And that is generally disproved, because the kohen does not have the right to decline his kavod. Now, he can walk out, and if the kohen sees that there's a need for more aliyahs, and that his being there would require his using up two aliyahs, then he can leave the room voluntarily. But for him to stay in the room and to say, we're calling up a Yisrael, with the permission of the Kohen, the halacha says that that is not permissible. The Kohen cannot give permission to decline his son. I never ate from a animal from whom the proper gift offerings had not been taken. Now, this is a practice that, even though it's written specifically in the Torah, some people seem to be unaware of. Now, we do know that when grain is taken off of the field, that there is a requirement for tithing, truva and maisa, and that no one is permitted to partake of that, of the produce, without the tithing being given. That's teva, and it's a very strict prohibition to eat from untithed produce. There is also a mitzvah that when a person shechts a animal for himself, now this is not referred to buying meat in the meat market, that if a person shechts an animal for himself, that he give to the Kohen the forepaw, the cheeks, and the stomach. Now these are the matnas kahuna, the gifts of kahuna, from an animal which is not a sacrificial animal, but one that is going to be used for personal use. And if these gifts are not given, this does not make the behemoth tevel. Not giving these gifts is just having neglected a mitzvah, but does not make the behemoth prohibitive. In other words, you're permitted to eat even though the tithings, the gift offerings, have not been given from the animal. And here he says that he was cautious not to eat from a behemoth from whom these gift offerings had not been given, even though this was in no way prohibited, but again, an example of Chassidus in doing that which is not required. It's interesting that in all of these examples, it says we have the Talmidim asking the Rebbe. And I think the importance of that is that here the Rebbe is responding in each case with telling of his virtuous practices. Now, how do you do that and tell other people, look how virtuous I have been? And the answer is that a Rebbe is required to do so as in his role of teaching the Talmidim. And there are times when it is improper to be an onov. Because if they had asked, what have you done to merit long life? And if, as a act of humility, the Rebbe had answered, well, I haven't done anything, this is just a grace of Hashem, it's a chesed of Hashem that I've been given long life, I really didn't deserve it, that would have been anivus. But we would call this an anivus pesula, an improper humility, because here was an opportunity for him to teach his Talmidim a proper action, and this was not the time to be an onov. So there are times when we should say any yodea. Get into the habit of saying, I don't know, instead of showing off your immense knowledge. But that only goes so far, only reaches to a point. If your students ask you something and you know the teretz, and you're going to say, anivus, I don't know. Yeah. One of my rabbis, when he would sit among a group of, I remember one incident, this was so typical of him, was sitting among a group of scholars, and they had gotten into a question of a difficult Rambam, where there was a contradiction in the Rambam, and each one had tried to give a version to explain the contradiction in the Rambam, and he just sat very quietly by and said nothing. And finally, when they finished their discussion and nobody had really said anything completely satisfactory to that was acceptable to everyone, he said in a very quiet tone, well, maybe you can say something like this. So he waited until everybody had exhausted their opinions, and had anyone else said what he felt was the correct shot, he would not have said it. He didn't have to show off that he had the correct shot. But waiting till everyone had said their piece, and still nobody having said what he felt was the correct shot, it was then that he said, well, maybe you can say something like this. And that's an indication of anivus, of proper anivus, waiting, well, maybe somebody else will say. That, is, incidentally, is a good example of how sincere a person means it. We talked about this in regard to doing a mitzvah, a public mitzvah. Is it being done sincerely or is it being done for show? And one of the tests is, suppose somebody else had done it. Right? Would you be equally as pleased as when you're doing it? Now, if it's a question of the thing getting done, right, if that's what your intention is, that the project should be done, then it really, you wouldn't care whether you did it or somebody else did it, as long as it gets done. If it's, no, I must do it. And if the thing gets done by somebody else, it'll displease me because I didn't do it, that may be suspect that you're doing it for the glory of it. The Amr Oid, the Gemara says further, Shalu Talmid Avas Rav Nachunya. The students asked Rav Nachunya, V'meh harachta yomim. What was, by what virtue did you have long life? Amar Lahem, and he said to them, Mi yomar lo niskabadati b'klein haveri. I never accepted any kind of honor at the expense of someone else's embarrassment. Le'ol sal mitosi kilalas haveri. And I never went to bed with any kind of hostility toward anyone else. So that if anyone had provoked me before going to bed, I would totally forgive him. Now, that's part of our Shema. In the long Shema, it says that I am meichel to anybody who may have offended me today. And a tefillah that no one should be punished or made to suffer because of anything that was done to me. These are both examples of chassidus between a person, one person and another one. It is certainly not that, it does not mean that he, as we'll see shortly, that he did not belittle anyone in order to gain honor for himself. That's not what he's referring to. But he even avoided accepting any kind of honor that would be at someone else's expense. And I think that we'll pause here and continue with this tomorrow.